Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 3rd of September. This hour, should the minimum wage be $10.10 an hour or higher? Senator Tom Harkin and Representative George Miller have proposed such a wage, which would affect 28 million working Americans, but it's going nowhere in Congress at the moment. Tomorrow, in 100 cities across the country, fast food workers will again go on strike. They are seeking a $15 an hour wage. The question has been asked, would that wipe out the profit margins at many restaurants? Our guest this hour from the Economic Policy Institute says one simple way we could significantly improve the lives of millions, help spur wage growth, and also reduce the gender pay gap would be to raise the minimum wage. What do you think? We'll be welcoming your phone calls this hour on this issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. President Barack Obama, at his appearance on Monday at Labor Fest, also called for a higher minimum wage.
Most of the policies I'm talking about have two things in common. They're going to help more working families get ahead. And the Republicans who run our Congress oppose almost all of them. Don't boo. Vote. Don't boo. Vote. If we had a Congress that cared about policies that actually help working people, I promise you we could get everything done that we've talked about doing. But until we have that Congress, it's up to us to fight for these policies. So wherever I can, I've acted on my own. That's why I acted on my own to make sure companies that receive federal contracts, that they pay their workers a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour. If you work full-time in America, you shouldn't be living in poverty. You shouldn't be trying to support a family on poverty. And in the year and a half since I first asked Congress to raise the minimum wage, of course, the Republicans in Congress have blocked it, but more and more Americans are doing their part to make it happen. This is why I stay optimistic, even with some of the nonsense that goes on in Washington.
David Cooper is our guest this hour. He's an economic analyst with the Economic Policy Institute, conducts national and state-level research on the minimum wage, employment and unemployment, poverty and wages, and income trends. He believes that raising the federal minimum wage would significantly improve the lives of millions, help spur wage growth, and reduce the gender pay gap. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David again. Our number is 800-486-8655. Hello, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
You wrote an interesting piece in the National Journal, August 28, in which you singled out women in the workforce and said a pretty amazing thing. The only reason we've seen any improvement in living standards for most U.S. households over the past 40 years has been more women entering the workforce.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? It's a funny thing to think that over the last four decades, the only reason why American families are any better off is because they're actually working more hours. And the big increase there comes from women entering the workforce and women working more hours on the job. It's not from people getting paid anymore. It's just from those families having to spend more time at work. That's the only reason why their income has actually increased since 1979.
Mm. And you also point out the fact, a new study by the Pew Research Center, 40% of U.S. households with children, women are the sole or primary earners of income.
Yeah, again, just really understating this fact that how we pay women in our country is going to determine the living standards, not only for a lot of families, but for a lot of children in this country. So we have to be concerned about how women are getting paid. We have to be concerned about how both men and women are getting paid. But women more now than ever before.
When we look at minimum wage, frequently this term, our productivity is also tied with that. When you look at productivity growth, it's been pretty phenomenal since the 1960s. When you look at wage growth, it has been pretty dismal. What does productivity growth mean?
Sure. So productivity is this fancy word that economists use that basically just means how much stuff we can produce from an hour's worth of work. And how much, and you know, if you think about that stuff being able to be then sold for something, it's a measure of how much income we can generate from each hour of work. And as you noted, we've seen this really, really troubling thing happen over the last 35 years where productivity in this country has continued to go up and up. So in other words, our ability to generate income from our work has gone up and up and up. But the typical worker in this country is really getting paid no more than they were 35 years ago. And it's important to note that this wasn't always the case. If you look at what happened for the first 30 years after World War II, as productivity went up, worker pay went up right in step with productivity. Until right around 1979, we had this break where productivity continued to rise and pay remained stagnant. So today, when you look at the numbers, productivity in 2013 was up about 65% from 1979, but pay for the median worker in America, basically the typical worker in America, was only up about 6%. So again, the huge difference there, 65% growth in productivity, only 6% in wage growth. And if you add on things like benefits, if you look at, you know, the pay that they're getting plus retirement benefits, healthcare benefits, even including that those fringe benefits, total compensation for the typical worker is only up about 8%. So once again, it's this huge problem that we're seeing, this stagnation in wages. And what we would argue here at the Economic Policy Institute is that this is really the central economic challenge that our country is facing right now.
We mentioned at the top of the show, Senator Tom Harkin and Representative George Miller have proposed raising the wage to $10.10. The president gave a pretty impassioned plea for the minimum wage to be at $10.10. You write that that would lift wages for a huge number of people, 28 million working Americans.
Yeah, it's remarkable. That's almost a fifth of the entire U.S. workforce. And the reason why it would raise wages for so many folks, people think that, you know, when you're talking about minimum wage workers, that you're just talking about this tiny sliver of workers who are just entering the workforce. But when you raise the minimum wage, you're not just lifting wages for folks that are right at the bottom. You're also going to lift wages for people that are making just above the minimum wage. So, you know, if we raise the minimum wage to $10.10, you're certainly going to raise wages for everyone earning between $7.25 and $10.10. But you're also going to lift wages for folks that are earning just above $10.10. This is what we call the spillover effect, where basically if you're raising that wage floor, think about, say, a manager at a fast food restaurant who's making $10.50 an hour. Well, if everyone that they're managing suddenly is making $10.10 an hour, their wage is probably going to have to go up as well just to maintain some distance, some internal wage ladder within that company. So when you look at the total group of folks that would benefit from a minimum wage increase, you're looking at almost 28 million workers.
So considering the fact that a big majority of Americans would favor an increase to $10.10, why is this bill going nowhere?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of, there hasn't been a lot happening in Congress these days. Unfortunately, Republicans have been pretty adamant that they don't want to raise the minimum wage. And as you noted, that's unfortunate because a majority of Americans support this, including in all the polls I've seen, a majority of Republicans. So it's really just a function of the public will not translating into congressional action. The one positive thing I'll say is that we are seeing a lot of action at the state level because of this congressional inaction. We're seeing just in the last year, we had 5 states raise the minimum wage in 2013, and then another 10 states raised their minimum wage in 2014. So right now, there's 26 states plus the District of Columbia that have state minimum wages higher than the federal minimum wage. The states are really getting out ahead of Congress on this. Congress is basically dragging its feet on an issue that a lot of Americans support.
And what's happened to small businesses? Because we do hear worries from many small businesses that if you increase the wage, you would wipe out a lot of profit margins at many small restaurants. Has that been the case, or has it not been around long enough to study what the effects are?
Well, actually, this is probably the most studied topic in all of economics. What happens when you raise the minimum wage to employment? There's a very long literature on this going back to the 1960s and 1970s, and you often hear people say this thing that you hear opponents of raising the minimum wage say all the time, that, oh, if you raise the minimum wage, you're going to, you know, lose jobs. And the reason why they say this is because the earliest studies on the minimum wage seem to confirm this basic Econ 101 textbook understanding of the minimum wage. But then in the 1990s, there was a new wave of research on this topic that looked specifically at what happened in border counties, in states, neighboring states, where one state raised its minimum wage and the other one didn't. They said, well, if we look at the border counties along the state line, we can see exactly what happens in counties that are pretty similar to each other, except for the fact that there's a state border going through them. And what they found is that in the states where the minimum wage went up, employment actually went up relative to the counties and the states where the minimum wage did not go up. And so this sort of threw the economics profession into a bit of an academic fight in the journals, in academic journals. And since then, there's been a lot more research done on this. And the best research we have shows that modest increases in the minimum wage have no measurable effect on employment. And the reason for this is because, you know, businesses are able to absorb those costs in a number of different ways. The biggest one is that when you raise the minimum wage, turnover tends to go down. And turnover can be a significant cost for a lot of businesses. They spend a lot on recruiting, hiring, and training new workers, and they don't have to do that as much if the minimum wage goes up. Raising wages also tends to lead to higher productivity among the workers. The workers just tend to work harder. And if those things don't recoup the additional cost for businesses, then they can, you know, raise prices slightly if they need to adjust to that additional expense. But typically those price increases have been very, very small, so small that most people don't notice them, and the businesses tend to do better.
Tomorrow, once again, there will be fast food workers going on strike, evidently, in 100 cities around the country. They're asking for a $15 an hour wage. What do you think of these strikes by fast food workers? Are they advancing the issue, and what do you make of their request for $15 an hour?
Well, I think they certainly are raising the issue. They're certainly elevating the issue in terms of the public consciousness. I think a lot of people were, you know, we've had a lot of talk since the Occupy Wall Street movement about income inequality, but we haven't really heard so much about wages. And if you really want to get at inequality, it's, you know, where does inequality come from? It comes from wages, stagnation of wages, wage inequality, simply because that's the way that most Americans get their income, is through what they get in their paycheck at the end of each week. So you can't really talk about inequality without talking about wages. And these strikes have done a good job of elevating the issue of wages and really unlivable wages at a lot of these jobs. In terms of $15, in some ways, you know, it seems like a really ambitious target, considering that the minimum wage right now is only $7.25 at the national level. But in some ways, it only looks large because of how low we've let the minimum wage fall. Back in the late 1960s, the minimum wage, if you just adjust for inflation, the minimum wage at its highest point in 1968 would have been roughly $10 an hour in today's dollars. And if the minimum wage since that time had grown with productivity growth, it would be almost $19.
Really?
So, you know, the point is that the economy certainly has the capacity for a much higher minimum wage, and in that context, 15 doesn't really look that big.
So you've looked at a number of years here in wages among different groups of people. Who has done really well over the last, I don't know, fill in the blank, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years?
So pretty much over every period, the group that's always done well is the top 1% that, you know, we hear a lot about the top 1%. It's really more like the top 0.1% that's done exceptionally well. But everyone kind of in the top, you know, 5% or so, wages have consistently gone up for that group. For pretty much everyone else, wages have either been flat or they've fallen. You know, as I mentioned, the median worker, the someone right in the middle who earns more than 50% of all workers and less than 50% of all workers, that person's seen their wages go up about 6% over the last 35 years. In the last you know, 10 years or so, it's been a decline for many of those workers. In fact, over that 35-year period, the only time when wages went up for the vast majority of workers was in the late 1990s, when we had really, really low unemployment to the point where employers were having to really bid each other up just to get the workers that they needed. And at that time, we saw broad wage growth for just about everyone, particularly those workers at the bottom.
It is amazing when you just said that people aren't really very upset about this, because everybody works hard, and evidently from what you're saying, they've worked even harder. They're very productive. They're not seeing any income growth. It's harder to make a living, and yet one group of people is doing just fine, thank you, and it's so few people. You would think that it would be extremely upsetting to almost every working person.
Well, I think, unfortunately, a lot of people just aren't aware or haven't been aware until recently about this issue, that, you know, it's only been sort of a select group of folks that are really studying this issue that really understood that wages are at the core of this. We've all kind of had a sense that, you know, there was some folks that were doing better than others, but, you know, most people like to think of themselves as middle class and like to think that they're doing okay. You know, it's they don't really think about how well they could be doing if the rewards from economic growth were distributed a little differently. And we actually looked at this in our paper. We did a little simulation that looked at what would happen for the typical American household had income growth over the last 35 years been equally distributed, just a hypothetical. If there had been no increase in inequality since 1979, what would the typical U.S. family look like today? And what we came up with was that a typical U.S. household would have about $18,000 more in annual income today if there had been no growth in income inequality since 1979. So really a pretty substantial difference for a lot of folks.
David Cooper is our guest this hour, economic analyst with the Economic Policy Institute. We're talking about the minimum wage, fast food workers going on strike in 100 cities tomorrow. Certainly not all of them, but a substantial number. And we've had several such strikes in the last few months. The president here in Milwaukee on Labor Day calling for an increase in the minimum wage. He also talked about unions, and we'll ask David about the decline of unions and what effect that's had on wages being pretty stagnant for a long period of time. We asked the general question this hour, do you think the minimum wage should be at $10.10 an hour, or do you think that it would be bad for businesses in this country? What do you make? We've talked about this issue many times, but the only people who seem to be doing well in this economy, and it's been true for many, many years now, are those who are in the 1% of income brackets, or as David said, more accurately, the 0.1%. What do you make of all of that? We're going to your phone calls in just one moment, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're speaking about the minimum wage this hour of the program with David Cooper, and the Economic Policy Institute has put together a recent report raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 would lift wages for millions and provide a modest economic boost. What do you think? To your phone calls, we start with Marty in Osseo. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. When did we stop losing pace? It's nauseating to know that the minimum wage should be almost $20 an hour now. When did we start losing pace and why? And I'm going to hang up. Thanks.
Thanks, Marty. David?
Yeah, so as I said, the minimum wage hit its highest point in 1968, and then since then there's been periodic increases. Through the 1970s, it maintained a level sort of just below that, but then really the largest decline took place in the 1980s. The minimum wage wasn't raised for about 10 years, and then again from the increase in the mid-1990s, around 1996, it wasn't increased again until 2007. So those two periods is when the minimum wage really declined the most. So that today, as I mentioned, it's worth about 25% less than it was back then. But this larger issue of stagnant wages has been occurring, you know, over that whole time period. And it's not, you know, in truth, it's not just because of the minimum wage. It's from a whole host of other factors. But the bottom line is that we've made a lot of policy decisions over that time period that have shifted bargaining power away from workers and more towards corporations and CEOs, so that workers really haven't been getting more pay, even though they've been generating more income for those employers.
Ralph is next in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to point out something or a scenario that I think may occur. In fact, it's probably guaranteed it's going to occur, and that is that the House votes for a $1.10 per hour increase in the minimum wages. It passes. It goes to the Senate. The Senate adds different stipulations to that, maybe changes in social programs, maybe certain workers that they feel should get more than $10.10 per hour, and then they send it back to the House, and the House votes it down because now it's not a nice, clean $10.10 per hour. It's got all kinds of extra things in it. When the House votes it down, then the Democrats blame the Republicans because they're obstructionists, and it's just a big political game. And I think if you could have a nice, clean bill that just said, no exceptions, $10.10 per hour minimum wage throughout the United States for all workers, part-time farm workers, food servers, everybody. If they left it alone, it would pass.
So I wish that were true. I really do. Unfortunately, I'm not entirely convinced. I do agree that there's a lot of political gamesmanship that's been going on, but there actually has been a bill, the Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2014, and actually before there was a Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2013, introduced in the Senate by Senator Harkin and Congressman, and then in the House by Congressman Miller, and that was a clean bill to raise the minimum wage to $10.10. They did add some business sweeteners, some things that they thought would appeal to more conservative legislatures, some tax breaks for businesses. And in the Senate, they couldn't even get it past a filibuster. They couldn't get it out for a vote.
Thank you, Ralph, for the call. Adam sends this email. I think everyone in this country should make at least $15 an hour. I realize this will make goods and services more expensive, though, virtually nullifying any kind of progress made by an across-the-board minimum wage increase. What are some solutions, please?
So this is another fear that people have when you talk about raising the minimum wage, that it's going to lead to higher prices for everything and effectively nullifying the increased income that folks have. And while there would be some increase in prices potentially, particularly in the industries that employ a lot of low-wage workers, like fast food in particular, these increases would be very small. In fact, there have been studies that have looked at this that have found that from about a 10% increase in the minimum wage, you saw an increase in prices in these heavily affected industries of about 1 to 3%. So we're talking about people earning 10% more and having to pay maybe, you know, 1.5% more in prices. So the increase in terms of what folks would be getting in pay is dramatically larger than any price increase, simply because the cost of low-wage work as a share of total business costs is a pretty small fraction of overall business costs in most businesses.
Let's talk about unions for a moment. The president said some interesting things when he was here on Monday. He said, if I had a service sector job and wanted an honest day's pay for an honest day's work, I'd join a union.
Yeah.
And yet we've seen unions not nearly at the level that they used to be. Has this been a major contributing force to wage stagnation?
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the biggest factors in terms of why we've seen wage stagnation, is that as less and less of the workforce is unionized, it's harder to bargain for higher wages. And back in 1973, more than a quarter of all U.S. workers, about 26%, 27%, were in unions. And when you have a larger share of the workforce that's in unions, not only does that benefit those workers, but it actually lifts wages for even the non-unionized workforce, because the employers of those non-union workers has to compete with the union shop that's paying higher wages if they want to be able to hire anybody. But over the last you know, 35-plus years, that unionization rate has gone down dramatically to the point today where only about 11.3% of the labor force is unionized, and a lot of that is in the public sector. If you look at just the private sector, it's only about 7%, less than 7% of the private sector is in a union today. And as I said, that has this depressing effect on wages more generally, because not only do the workers in the unions, not only are there fewer workers protected by unions, but you don't have the union shops bidding up wages for folks who are not in unions.
David, do you see that changing? Do you see unions starting to flourish anytime in the future?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there is a lot of interest in joining a union right now. In fact, there's a researcher at Harvard, Richard Freeman, who studies this extensively, and he found, I believe in 2007, that about 50% of all non-union workers wanted to be unionized. And that was the highest level he'd ever recorded. So clearly there's a lot of interest in this. Unfortunately, the law hasn't been as kind to that process. There's been a lot of changes in labor law in the last several decades that have made it harder for workers to become organized. And the National Labor Relations Board has reported a large increase in the number of workers that are filing complaints for being fired for trying to organize. So it's really an open question as to what is going to happen to unions over the next few years. But certainly a lot of folks want to be in a union.
Mike in Madison, hi.
Hi. Unfortunately, I believe it should be much higher than $10 as well. And I understand that the pushback against that is because those that benefit the most from the depressed wages really don't want to do that. And unfortunately, again, they're in positions of power to make sure that happens. Now, what I'd like people to understand that this is way less political than they think. It's basically about ownership versus worker. And when you look at and continue to pay those at the top who do the least and make the most, and the reason why I can argue that is, over the last 30 years, I believe they've gone from 30 times the rate of wealth or pay to them versus their worker to into the 400s. And I seriously doubt that they can argue it's because they are much more productive and have a higher workload that they're doing. What's actually happening, and when you raise the wage, the reason why this shouldn't affect goods and products at all is services is because those who would have to stop stealing would actually be paid back, okay? So those wages don't have to affect it. And I have evidence, for example, in Australia. I believe the minimum wage there is $16.56 per hour, which means that a McDonald's worker starts at that. And, again, I think a Big Mac there is like 32 cents cheaper there than it is here. So where's that money going? It's going to those at the top.
All right, let's get a response. I don't know that about Australia. Is that true in Australia?
I know that their minimum wage is about $15,
$16
an hour. I don't know what the cost of a Big Mac is there, but that is
KP
true.
KP is on the case. We'll find out.
That's right. We do. They do have a much higher minimum wage there. That's true. And their economy does quite well. What the gentleman was talking about executive to worker compensation, you know, he's right that back in the 70s, the typical CEO made about 30 times what the typical worker made. And today, the typical CEO makes about 270 times what a typical worker in that same industry makes. So we have seen this huge explosion in CEO and executive pay. And he's right. It's hard to think that those folks are really that much more productive than they were 30 years ago.
We had a Facebook comment from someone. How about announcing wage on CEOs that would be different? In Switzerland, CEOs can make no more than 12 times the wage of the lowest paid worker. Why not have such a law in America?
Again, that's a possibility. I mean, we could always do something like that. But, you know, the thing is, we actually wouldn't need to make those sorts of straight legal policy prescriptions if we just had stronger unionization rates, if we just had more collective bargaining. You know, in some ways, you know, there are some European countries that don't have minimum wages, but the lowest wage that they pay in those countries is much higher than our minimum wage. And the reason for that is because they have collective bargaining, industry-wide collective bargaining, so that collective bargaining establishes, a union establishes what the wage will be, what the minimum wage will be for everyone in that industry. And so they never need to establish any sort of legislation establishing a minimum wage. And so, yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of policies we could enact to try and restrict executive pay and lift typical worker pay. But in some ways, we wouldn't need to do that if we just had stronger unions.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Cindy in De Pere. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Cindy.
Oh, sorry. I didn't hear you say Cindy. I guess the last couple callers were pretty much making the point that I was. I just kind of feel like, okay, if we raise the minimum wage, which I wish we would because it would help me a lot, it's got to come from someplace. And, I just kind of feel like the people at the top would have to be in agreement and have to maybe not need to have as much as they do. And I guess I'll take the comment off the air.
Are you making the minimum wage, Cindy? Cindy's gone.
Well, Cindy's gone. But what I can say about that is that, you know, the when we looked at the folks that would be helped by a minimum wage increase, the majority of them are women. About 56% are women. And many of them have children. About a quarter of them have children. So I don't know if that's Cindy's situation, but we do know that women would be the majority beneficiaries of a minimum wage increase. And what she was saying is you know, I would agree with her that there is certainly a lot of income and a lot of income growth that has gone to the highest paid folks. And, you know, if we raise the wage floor, some of the additional income going to low wage workers could certainly come from corporate profits, which are at an all-time high right now.
Well, this also, and tell me about this change in philosophy, if indeed there's been a significant change. The idea of having your business model mean taking care of your shareholders versus, if there is a versus here, having your profits go toward your employees as well as your shareholders.
Yeah, there does seem to have been a little bit of a change in that, and some of that may be just sort of culture. Some of it may be related to changes in tax policy. In the early 1990s, there were some changes in tax policy about how we taxed income, that in the way that CEOs and executives were compensated, so that their pay was tied more to stock performance and things like that, so that it became more a question of trying to do everything you could to raise your stock prices. And you know, there's been a lot that's happened that has sort of established this business model that businesses need to cut costs, keep costs at a bare minimum, including labor costs, just so that they can eke out ever higher profits and keep those stock prices rising. And, you know, I think there's a lot of questions right now about not only how that's affected businesses, but how that's affected the economy at large, because as fewer and fewer people have been able to earn enough to go out and buy the things that they would buy, you know, what effect has that had on a growth in the economy overall? About 70% of our economy is driven by consumer spending. And so if fewer and fewer people have enough to go out and buy the things they need, that's going to weaken that consumer spending and slow down growth. That actually led to a report this year by S&P that said that they thought that growth and income inequality had actually slowed down recovery coming out of the recession. And that's a pretty remarkable thing to hear from S&P. So a lot of folks are questioning whether this is, you know, a good business model, not only for the country at large, but even for these businesses that want to have customers. They're not going to have customers if no one has money to spend.
And we checked on Australia, KP just did. Australia has a minimum wage of $16.87 an hour, but the cost of a Big Mac is $4.47, and that's compared to $3.57 in this country.
Okay.
Thank you, fact checker KP Whaley. We're going to take more phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about the minimum wage. The reason for it is because it was Labor Day. The president in Milwaukee called for a 10-10 an hour minimum wage. Tomorrow, fast food workers in this country will again be on strike. Some in some cities will be conducting sit-ins to ask for a $15 an hour minimum wage. And, you know, we keep hearing report after report that over a long period of time now, it's only people who are in the upper 1% or 0.1% who've done well at all since the 1960s in this country, that productivity is way up, but the minimum wage simply has not kept pace, and there are a lot of people who are working very hard and just are having a hard time getting by. So what do you think? 10-10 an hour? That's the question of the hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. The president had some interesting things to say. David has hinted at some of them about how some cities have raised their minimum wage. Also, he told some interesting stories about people who have cut their wages. So we'll hear again from some of his comments at Labor Fest and continue our conversation this hour with David Cooper. He is senior economic analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, and we'll be with you again in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, the president, who addressed some of the issues that we've been talking about this hour when he was in Milwaukee at Labor Fest just this past Monday.
You've seen business leaders at companies like The Gap that raised base wages for tens of thousands of workers because they knew it was good for business. You've seen mayors across the country doing their part. And today on Labor Day, the mayor of Los Angeles is announcing a plan to raise his city's minimum wage. You've seen, you know, here's a good story. Last month, the president of Kentucky State University, he gave himself a $90,000 pay cut so that he could raise wages for his lowest paid employees. 13 states, District of Columbia, they've raised their minimum wages. Four more states are putting minimum wage initiatives on the ballot in November. And you know what? Here's the best part. You'll hear opponents, they'll say, well, minimum wage, they're going to kill jobs. Except it turns out the states where the minimum wage has gone up this year had higher job growth than the states that didn't raise the minimum wage. That's the facts.
President Obama, Labor Fest on Monday of this week. This really caught my attention because you don't hear of too many people doing this. The president of Kentucky State University gave himself a $90,000 pay cut to take care of wages for his lowest paid employees. That's a rarity, isn't it, David?
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable. I think that, you know, that maybe speaks to that person's character, but also says a little bit about the difference between what top people at the top are making and people at the bottom are making. And clearly, you know, this president recognized that, you know, what he was making as a university president was more than enough that he needed to get by, and that a lot of folks at the bottom, even a little small increase in their pay was going to mean a lot to them.
Peter in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on, and thanks for taking up this topic. I'm particularly compelled about income inequality and wages, you know, in light of not only the president bringing this up, but even leaders like the Pope saying it's the defining challenge of our time. So it's really great you guys are shining a light on this. I have two questions. One is just beginning from the point of I think it's a fantasy to believe that the federal minimum wage is going to go up. You know, the politics in Washington, D.C. are so broken, and obviously we've seen over the past few years when there's been a minimum wage bill on the table, nothing's happened with it. I think we got to look to the states. And here in Wisconsin, I actually took a look at this because I think this issue is pretty important for our whole economy, whether we're middle class, working class, poor, or whatever. It turns out that Wisconsin's minimum wage law says that the governor can raise the minimum wage himself or herself. So I'm wondering if the guest could talk about this, what he knows about that, and what we can do right here in Wisconsin to raise wages. And then the second question I would have, just so you know, I can take the comments off air, is, you know, obviously a lot of people support this. 76% of Wisconsin voters support it, you know, across the country. It's huge majorities, Democrats, Republicans, Independents. Public support is behind raising wages, but obviously that's not moving these politicians to take action. So what do you think it's going to take, based upon your knowledge of history here, to win a higher minimum wage in Wisconsin and nationwide?
So I'm not an expert on Wisconsin law on this, but I think the caller's right that Wisconsin is actually unique in that the governor through the Secretary of Workforce Development can actually change the minimum wage through administrative processes. They don't have to go to the legislature if they don't want to. And I believe Governor Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin actually did this back in 1996, raised the minimum wage on his own. So it is true that I think the Wisconsin governor could raise the minimum wage if they wanted to. And to the caller's second point, and this is related, I guess, you know, I think it's really, as more and more public pressure builds around this issue, as more folks, you know, speak out about how low their wages are, and these protests that we're seeing taking place tomorrow is a big part of this, these fast food strikes, really elevating this issue, really putting the pressure on lawmakers to say whether they're going to, you know, enact a policy that's going to help a lot of folks or continue to protect just a very, very small segment of the population that's doing quite well and has been doing quite well for many, many years. I think a lot of the action, I think the caller's right, that a lot of the action on this is going to continue to happen at the state and local level. As I said earlier, there's now 26 states plus the District of Columbia that have state minimum wages higher than the federal minimum wage. That by next year, that'll be about 60% of the workforce. 60% of all U.S. workers will be in states with minimum wages above the federal minimum wage. So we're getting to this point where there's just a small number of states that where workers are essentially being left behind unless Congress acts.
Thank you, Peter, very much for your call. John in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I think a general principle would be that the poorer people and the middle class cannot be helped unless the ultra wealthy are really taxed strongly. The second thing is if they raise the lower the minimum wage to $15 an hour, how will that affect their taxes? In other words, should we give them a tax cut as well as a raise to $15 an hour for minimum wage?
Interesting. So two points there. So the first one on taxation of the wealthy, you know, I think it's certainly true that wealthy folks today are being taxed at much lower rates than they were many, many years ago. If you look back to the 50s and 60s, tax rates, marginal tax rates, the top marginal tax rate was like 70% or more. So when you have tax rates that are that high, marginal tax rates that are that high for really wealthy folks, the incentive to try and eke out every additional dollar that you can out of your business is much lower. Maybe you'll take those extra dollars and reinvest them in the business, maybe give them more to your workers. As those marginal tax rates have gone down, you know, those top executives, now they can get more out of each additional dollar that they can take out of the business. They can get more out of each additional dollar in profit. So maybe so that actually, you know, there's a lot of evidence that that's contributed to this explosion in incomes for folks at the top, the lowering of marginal tax rates. In terms of how it would affect how tax rates would be affected if there were an increase to $15, and I'm not sure if this is exactly what the gentleman was asking about, but there's actually a fair amount of evidence as well that if you raise the minimum wage, you lift a lot of folks out of needing public assistance. You'd have a lot less spending on things like Medicaid and food stamps and the EITC. Public programs that are financed through tax dollars. Well, if those folks don't need those public supports anymore because they're making more out of their job, then potentially you're going to have some budgetary savings. You may not need to tax as much as you already are to deliver the same level of services to people.
Thank you, John, for the call. Jim sends this email with an interesting question. At what point, David, does the responsibility fall on the worker to improve skills to qualify for a higher paying job? It's hard and time management priorities will need to change, but there are thousands of programs out there to help. It certainly is an immediate option.
Sure. So, you know, obviously getting more education and getting more skills is going to help anyone in terms of getting a better job and getting better pay. But the fact is, you know, we have to not think about the individual worker in these circumstances. We have to think about the occupation. We have to think about the job itself. Because even if one person gets more education and gets themselves a better job, somebody else is going to take that job. And the question is, do we want that job to be a low-paying job where anyone in that job has to rely on public benefits just to make ends meet? Or do we want that to be a decent job where folks get enough money to live on without having to turn to public benefits and, you know, being able to to afford things like more education. You know, it's really hard to afford tuition payments and get more education if you're only making, you know, $7.25 an hour or some really low pay. And in fact, when we look at the folks that do that are our lowest paid workers, minimum wage workers, and folks close to the minimum wage, we actually know that today's low wage workers are vastly better educated than minimum wage workers in the 1960s. Today's workers tend to be much better educated and much older on average than low wage workers in the 1960s, yet they're being paid about 25% less than their counterparts in the 1960s. So it's not really a question of education and skills. It's a question of how we have chosen through policy to spread the rewards of economic growth, and how we've decided to establish a wage floor at a level, you know, that's we've let erode over the last 40 years.
Steve in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I want to echo what he just said about in the 60s. We didn't have, I'm semi-retired now, but I was a boomer, so I lived in the 60s. I entered the workforce in the 60s. And at that point, the minimum wage approached $1.25 an hour. But the people that were making minimum wage were teenagers. It didn't apply to higher-educated older people. They were receiving a better wage. $1.25 an hour in the 60s compares to 30 cents for a gallon of gas, 5 cents for a loaf of bread, $6 for a pair of brand-new blue jeans. It's about 10 times more by inflation. So it should be, even if we kept the same standard, $12.50 instead of $1.25 an hour, if we were to equal just what we were doing in the 60s. But still, we're paying a lot of older people, a lot of more people are settling for minimum wage in this period, and I think that needs to be adjusted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the gentleman's right. As I was saying, the folks that are making these wages are a lot older today, and in our study of who would be affected by an increase in the federal minimum wage to 10-10, the average age of affected workers is 35 years old. Only about 12% of the workers that would be affected are teenagers. So teenagers are a very small portion of the workers we're talking about.
Thank you very much, Steve, for your call. Jonathan in Fox River Valley. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the program. What is magical about 10-10? Did a lot of research go into this, or was there just a calculation and this is the number we're going for? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So that's a great question. When the 10-10 is what the congressional leaders introduced the bill at, and 10-10 is roughly what the minimum wage was back in the late 1960s at its highest point. So essentially, getting up to 10-10 would get us back to where we were 45 years ago. Now, as I said, there's a lot of folks who would say, well, we should be doing a lot better than we were doing 45 years ago, and that's why you see these strikes and a lot of people calling for things like $15. So basically, 10-10 is kind of a bare minimum in the sense that it gets us back to where we were 45 years ago. If you think that people, if you think that the lowest paid worker in America should be getting more than they were 45 years ago, then you need to start talking about something higher than 10-10.
And thank you very much for your call. One more call, and then we're almost out of time here. Rick in Wood County. Hi.
Yeah, my name is Rick. I'm part of a Wood County group or Central Wisconsin group called Central Wisconsin Grassroots Alliance. And we worked really hard and got the resolution on our ballot in Wood County for the November 4th ballot very narrowly, but it took 40 of us to show up and 10 of us to testify to get that done.
What's on the ballot?
And the problem is that we need to get minimum wage workers to the polls to vote. Because, you know, when you have 70 to 80% of the people in favor of minimum wage raise, but they're not responding to their constituents, I think it's because maybe a disproportionate number of minimum wage workers are discouraged and they're just not showing up to vote, so politicians don't think they need to listen to them. That's my comment.
David, we have about 30 seconds.
Well, yeah, I agree. If we're going to see any change in this, then people have to go and vote and put pressure on lawmakers. The only thing I'd say is that it's hard to even take a day off of work to go and vote necessarily. If you're only making $15,000 a year, mm-hmm. maybe that's more reason to have more early voting and extended voting hours.
Yeah, and you don't have personal days or sick days or
exactly
things like that as well. Well, this was an interesting hour, David. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Sure. We'll talk again. David Cooper, our guest. David is an economic analyst, and he works with the Economic Policy Institute. His special areas, the minimum wage, employment and unemployment, poverty and wage and income trends. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the program and for doing research while he was answering phone calls and doing 10 things at once. And thanks for all of your calls and your interest in this subject. News is coming up from National Public Radio. We will return.